Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Amy Powell joins us. The Monday Art Club starting up in Easton. Also, 9/11, the anniversary is coming up, and we look tonight at George Bush's role as a puppet on the day. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join us, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen Square on 0117 989 7733 or online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But first this week, joining me on the line is Sabine McNeil. Hi, Sabine.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, your website, victimsunite.net, just tell us about your role in this, because you seem to coordinate between quite a lot of people who are having trouble in different ways. What are the main themes on your site?
Well, the themes are emerging as I meet people, Tony. It developed from the meetings that I organized at the House of Lords, which at the time we're focusing on forum stable currencies, i.e. the monetary analysis, but that's where victims showed up and I wanted to help them and I didn't know how.
So how did you go from analysing the money system to victims?
Well, they came to me and I realised that they would just be happy to get some kind of acknowledgement by having a summary of their story published. And that's how I started. In fact, I started the first cases on the website called Enforcement of Bank of England Act 1694. And Lord Sudley had said, with whom I had started the Forum for Stable Currencies, he had said that we must group cases to change the law. So that's how I actually began and why I began to group cases. And I started with the four worst fraudulent bankruptcies.
What about, I mean, stable currencies? At the moment, we don't seem to really have that, do we? We're in a situation where it seems that any minute the world could go crazy if the Chinese stock market crashes. And we're also in a situation in Europe with the Eurozone that there's not a lot stable about Greece. Even though the euro itself seems to be stable, there's something wrong. Greece is really suffering, and other countries too.
Or what is wrong with the monetary system all over the world is terribly fundamental, and it's very sad how few people understand and know that. At the time when we tried to find the right name for the Forum for Stable Currencies, Donald Martin, whom I had invited to chair, said if we call it stable, we should get the Bank of England behind us. But of course, we never did, because we found out that they are just dealing with money and currencies like everybody else who make money out of money, which is, of course, the deadly sin in Islam, which links back to your terrorism story, because in my view, that's exactly why Muslims have become terrorists, because they know what should happen with money. So for a currency to be stable, it should, first of all, not to be traded. I mean, by trading currencies, you change the price, you change the market value.
Well, it does seem that we have quite a lot of gambling. It's almost like the casino and the bank marketplace has become one.
Absolutely. I mean, yes. It's completely casino capitalism. And when I was in Germany, everybody was just talking about fake money, as you know, instead of fiat money, because that's what it boils down to. It's completely ridiculous what's happening. And what's more ridiculous, how many people buy into it. And of course, what's most ridiculous is that we don't have a choice. We have to just go along with it. So one of my dreams is to create the ethical investment network to make money out of money, which is, of course, completely against my principles. But at least before I die, I need to do something good with it, you know. So that's the project, one of the projects I'm after and trying to reiterate or revitalize.
You're talking about the Islamic approach to finance there. I mean, I know, for example, you know, that they take a very serious view of things like as simple as interest. In fact, if you go back a couple of hundred years in Britain, apparently the Christian law was the same, wasn't it? You know, they had church courts and things like that, and there wasn't usury, it was called, was illegal in Britain, and in fact across most of Europe in the Protestant world.
Absolutely. Lord Sudley, with whom I founded the Forum for Stable Currencies at the House of Lords at the time, had written very beautifully about it, that it's been forbidden in all philosophies, but in Islam, in a way, most explicit. Making money out of money is a deadly sin called riba. And yes, taking interest, i.e. lending and borrowing at interest, is not on, and that is based on the mathematics of compounding interest, which is exponential, which is the real reason why everybody talks about growth. I mean, that is an infinite growth. I mean, Margaret Kennedy had written about that. And of course, stable currencies are experienced in locally exchanged trading systems and barter companies.
Well, we've got the Bristol Pound here in the city here.
Yes, and that's why my model has always been what happens in let systems and barter companies, but I don't know whether I was ahead of my time or whether it's just, I guess it's just too big a system to be up against, and one can only make a difference if one is maybe part of the system rather than outside.
Well, I heard you may have heard this story too, Sabine, I'm not sure. This is, I think, back in the 1990s, some people working on coming up with alternatives to the financial system as we have it now had decided to spend, I think it was almost like a retreat, discussing it and to draft a kind of better system for enabling people to bring in let's schemes around the country. That is, these alternative currencies like the Bristol Pound kind of thing, but almost like a Bible of how to do it and how to make it work, including things like, you know, get your local authority on board by enabling people to pay a small amount of their council tax or rates or whatever, you know, using this currency, and that would be effective. And they were traveling back home from wherever it was, and they stopped. I think the woman I spoke to said it was on Silbury Hill, and they left the car at the bottom of the hill, went up and had a sort of lie in the sun, and almost contemplating what they were doing. When they came back to the car, they found the car had been broken into and all their notes stolen, and as a result of that, what she told me, I wish I could remember her name, I can't, what she told me was that she went back home and wrote the paper, which effectively ended up as a pamphlet, just from memory, because all the words had been stolen from the car. And actually, it was a fantastic, paper. It was very successful, and it helped a lot of let schemes in the 1990s get off the ground. The irony being that she was then phoned, I think, just after the publication of the pamphlet by Wiltshire Police to say, "Oh, we found all your papers." But anyway, look, what I'm really asking here about is, I'm just asking for you to explain to us a bit more about the connection between people coming to you. I mean, you've got a bit of a think tank going there about looking at the money system, what's wrong with it, how to fix it, and then you get victims of the money system coming.
Well, that's exactly the point. If we had a proper money system, we wouldn't have the victims that we have. The money system is the cause, the victims are the effects, because there is never enough money around. And of course, the seduction of buying more and consuming more.
But hang on, I've got to stop you there, because for some people there is. I mean, there seem to be people out there who've got lots of money to invest, even just buying empty buildings, almost like it's money in the bank, just as an investment. You know, so some people, and also, of course, a lot of big corporations that haven't been paying their tax, they are swimming in money. So there are some people around, even if it's only the 1%, with quite a lot of money.
Yes, but of course that is the, if you like, the mechanism of compounding interest on interest as well. And of course the main interest that is being imposed is always on the government, i.e. the national debt. And that effect of demanding money on the government budget and having that built in, of course, means that all of the public services go down. And there's never enough money for health and education, but always for other bad things. And yes, Letzlink is still going. Professional barter companies are still going. And there is also a group of technologists who are very interested in making a difference in the financial system. But if, whether, and when it will make enough of a difference so that really the whole gap is closed between the 1 and the 99%, or appears at least to be closing. God only knows what has to happen, Tony.
Also, your Victims Unite these days tends to focus on this child snatching by the state business. And I know, I think, doesn't he write for the Daily Telegraph? Christopher Booker has been really good on this subject, getting some of these cases out to the general public.
Oh, yeah. Christopher Booker is the one and only journalist. And John Hemming was the one and only parliamentarian who've been very, very good. He writes for the Telegraph. He has a Sunday column, weekly column in the Telegraph. And climate change is one of his topics, and then the child snatching business. Yes, I just spoke to him recently about the case that came my way, which is so horrendous again. And he said, oh, yes, London Borough of Sutton is definitely amongst the worst. I mean, I hadn't come across that yet, but I ended up accompanying this wonderful Zimbabwean lady who had studied in Berlin civil engineering. So she was fluent in German. And her son had been taken into care by the police. I mean, it was just so ridiculous on May 8th, and now we all have problems trying to get him back. He, in
So,
fact,
sorry,
is,
get, tell us the circumstances. How was her child taken? Where?
He happened to have been in transit between Switzerland and Zimbabwe because they were relocating. They were going back to Zimbabwe after so and so many years in Switzerland. And visiting family in London, there was a bit of an issue, and one of the about the passport of the boy, and one of the relatives phoned the police, which was, of course, completely stupid. But the police, oh, there's a child. Oh, we can catch it. Oh, we can snatch it. So that was the beginning, and I just only read now the report of what they call a LAC, which is a looked after children, about a meeting held in June. We and I accompanied her yesterday to
But I
this
mean,
meeting.
surely, Sabine, you can understand the police's attitude, because they've been accused in the past of not acting tough enough right around the world on some of these children actually being abused, and then the police not intervening. So they've been criticised for that.
Police is just like social services. John Hemming always says social services get involved when they shouldn't, and they don't get involved when they should. So in this case, that's definitely also that applies to the police. And of course, social services can't take children without police. So police are heavily involved. And I mean, in this case, the boy has now been exposed to a hell of a lot of a bigger risk whilst in care, in quotes, than ever, ever, ever with his mother. And so this fundamental turning and inversion of innocence and guilt is what really gets to me. Would you believe it? First of all, I'm now reading that he tried to escape at least three times. Obviously, because he was unhappy. Then there was an incident where he had an excessive dose of drugs for some reason. And then he even got involved in a stabbing 30 miles away. God only knows how he got there.
And this is in care. This is
in
care.
Care. I saw him with his right hand still being bandaged. The mother had never been informed. The social worker bragged about having been with the boy till 10 o'clock at night. But would he call the mother? No, she didn't. She still has just had an absolute minimum of information. It is so terrible. And yesterday in the meeting, as a third incident, we learned that he had smoked cannabis in his room. And Tony, I can't remember the precise reason that they had given, but this boy had two staff. They call it 2-for-1 supervision 24 hours round, but not in his room. So they know that it was a past visitor who came, who must have given him this cannabis. But the so-called independent review officer said, if your son wants to get hold of drugs, he will, no matter what. So, I mean, excuse me, why can't they let the boy go?
Good question. I know also recently there's been the case of Joni Cameron-Blair. I'm not sure if you've come across that, Sabine, but she was up in Nottingham. She was in care herself as a youngster for a short time, and while she was, she witnessed rape going on in this particular care home in Nottingham. And when she left care, she was taken back by her parents into a much better situation. When she became a teenager in her early 20s, she then applied for a job and got it as a care home inspector, only to then find that the reports that she was doing were basically buried, and she'd go back maybe 1 or 2 years after she'd done a damning report about members of staff who were being abusive to the children in all sorts of different ways, using psychological bullying, this kind of thing, physical abuse, etc., to find those people still in their jobs.
I wouldn't be surprised because I now had this privilege of seeing two of such homes. I mean, they all look wonderful, and I was wondering, where does the money come from to equip them beautifully? There were two children in each of the homes and three staff. I mean, you can just imagine that this is what I call the people processing industry, children in, children out, but for what purpose? Who benefits? The staff that is there, okay, obviously once the council has employed some people, they must keep them going. But when I told the mother that he now suddenly wears his hair in a braided way, she was wondering whether they want to turn him into a gay boy. And when I spoke to him, he certainly was just sort of like any teenager nowadays, bored with life, not knowing what to do with himself. And then I learned, because they were exposed to the care plan and education, that he's supposed to go on to a sexual health workshop. And he was told, it says in the report, that having sex under 16 is a crime in the UK. I mean, who needs to expose him to that? Why?
Also, I mean, one of the recurring themes when we have a chat, Sabine, is just making sure that anyone listening that knows someone that's in one of these situations, either with a relative, friend, loved one, or whatever, that's knows somebody who's had a bad time in one of these official care homes, or else, the other way around, maybe they are actually in an abusive situation in a family of that kind of thing. I mean, where would you say? It's got to be the first point of call for people like that.
Well, unfortunately, our Mackenzie site does attract people, but I can't cope with individual cases anymore. Tony, I walked out weeping yesterday. I was in tears when I got a phone call from somebody today again. But we are just a handful of volunteers.
And what about lawyers, police? Where can one turn? I mean, the police do say, don't they, that really since the Jimmy Savile expose, that they're actually starting to take this much more seriously.
Well, maybe in words, but in deeds, I haven't seen yet. I mean, I mustn't talk about it, but I do know this police station now from the inside as well, and I cannot trust anybody at all. And with this mother also, she had already been disappointed by two solicitors. That's why she found us. And
What about, say, for example, internet forums, things like that, where at least people can discuss it? I don't know, even maybe Facebook, that kind of thing.
yes, that's exactly where people are getting together and help each other. That's precisely the one and only hope that we have.
Okay. Also, I know you've got an article on victimsunite.net about house stealing too. Never mind taking away the children, but stealing your home. What's that all about?
Well, that's how it all started for me, until I realized that child snatching was the worst of all white collar crimes. I mean, these fraudulent house repossessions and land registry fakes and, I mean, frauds, whether it's tax, whether it's land registry, I mean, force, you name it, I've seen it. And I always just feel helpless, basically. And at least there is some exposure. And, sadly enough, very, very many people just get some solace out of that and get over it. At least they've been heard. At least it's exposed. At least they can keep referring to the website and their case. if whether when things will change. I mean, once again, I just refer back to the money system. If we had a nicer, I mean, more sane, more balanced money system, people wouldn't go to these extremes of being as nasty as they are and abuse their public service positions. That's what it boils down to, in my view.
Okay, Sabine McNeill, editor, actually, not quite editor, of victims-unite.net. Thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined now by Rosa Hewitt and Amy Powell, who are looking at doing some art down in Eastern. Hi, Rosa, and hi, Amy.
Hello.
First of all, tell us a bit about yourself, Rosa. Are you actually an artist? Have you trained, or are you sort of self-made artist? Have you decided to get and do it yourself? Have you had any sort of formal training?
Well, I went to art school. I went and studied fine art at UWE in Bristol. And yes, I am an artist of sorts.
Okay, so what tell us about what you get doing fine art at UWE. So how is it? 3-4 years?
It's a 3-year degree, BA, and I completed that and finished it last year.
Take us through the sort of stuff you're doing as part of that 3 years. You know, what kind of?
Well, it's really dependent for each student. For me, I focused a lot on video work during my degree. But it's not necessarily my main interest in art. I'd say I'm a mixed media artist. I do a lot of drawing, I do a lot of painting, I write a lot as well, and that all fed into my video work. At the moment, I'm mainly drawing and painting. So,
I mean, is the idea of a degree like that that you start to discover your creative, you know, what makes you tick?
Yeah, I guess so. And also, understanding where you come at work conceptually and how that works, and also the use of facilities in a big university are incredible. So it's great to have that opportunity to be able to explore different mediums and different facilities.
And do you have to actually be able to draw, say, for example, be able to sketch, that kind of thing, with
no,
a pencil?
Not for a fine art degree, I don't think so. No, not necessarily. It's a lot to do with, you know, so many different things I could say about it, but in terms of drawing is not necessarily the main thing. You might be a drawer, you might be a painter, you might be abstract, you might be realist, but you know, everyone's completely different who were on our course anyway, so yeah.
What led you to do video? What was it attracted you about that?
Well, I did a lot of photography and I wanted to make the photos move, so I decided to make
That's
videos.
The only way, I think.
Yeah,
as far as I know.
That would work.
Unless you dangle a photo on a piece of string and let it
blow
in the wind.
Yeah, you could also do that.
Not quite the same, though.
But then I'd want to make a video out of that, too.
What did you discover about yourself as an artist during those 3 years? You know, what was it that you thought, you know, is it leading you in any particular directions?
Well, I think the main thing that I discovered about myself is that I can't fit myself into a box. I'm not necessarily going to be a big selling artist, and I also realise that that's not important, and also that I get joy out of making art, and that's the most important thing for me, is to just keep getting joy out of it, keep being creative, because I was going to go and study psychology before I decided to do a fine art degree. And I realised I couldn't let go of art, and I still can't let go of it. So I guess that's the reason why I studied it.
At the end of the day, do you think it's going to contribute towards an income? Is it contributing towards making money? I mean, because there's a lot of emphasis, certainly by the latest Conservative government, in we are only going to be spending money. Actually, of course, you have to borrow money now to do these courses. But how vocational is it, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, it really depends on what you decide to go and do. So a lot of people do internships afterwards, maybe work for artists, maybe becoming an artist yourself, I think, is very hard, you know, to be, you know, big selling artist. I don't think it's going to be my sole income, but I also think in a way for myself, it means that it's not going to take the life and soul out of what I'm making. And, you know, most important thing is that I keep enjoying it, and I don't really think it matters whether it's vocational or not, but, you know,
Just do it. Sounds to me like the approach. If you've got something you want to do, just get on and do it. What about you, Amy? Are you someone that's studied art at university, that kind of thing, or come to it just from your own inclinations?
Well, I went to the same university as Rosa.
Same course?
Yeah, the same course.
Same year?
Yeah, same course, same year. Same tutor group at one point as well. So we went for it together. And part of our course, we also did an Erasmus exchange as well, where you go to another university. So we both did that as well.
Okay, where did you go?
We went to Rotterdam. We went to William de Kooning in Rotterdam. And as part of that, we were doing some volunteer work, where we worked in a centre for sort of people who sort of had experience living on the streets or had mental health problems. And we were doing art with art at that centre, and we really enjoyed it. And then when we graduated, it just seemed like a really good idea to try and do a project together. So that's what we've decided to do.
So that sounds amazing. I mean, with people who've been living on the streets, what kind of artworks came out of that?
The centre was engaging people who wouldn't really engage with other services. So they had a sort of a music recording centre. So people, there's a lot of street hip-hop artists who were recording. And then they had painting as well. They had a room where people did painting. And we just joined in with what was going on, really. We didn't teach anyone anything. We just joined in. And it really worked very well. And it was, and I think it was good for the people who were at that centre to have other people coming in and sort of seeing the work we were doing, and it was great for us to see the work they were doing as well.
How long were you in Holland for then?
We were there for 6 months.
And how did you find it, compared to Bristol?
I don't know. I think it's a very different city, because it's a lot more built up, and it's a lot more sort of feels quite a lot more in. It's a much bigger city. And I think for me I went there trying to sort of see if I could build a new life in another country.
Yeah.
And that was kind of part of what I was trying to do there, and I got involved with couch surfing and got to know people, and I got to know a established squat, basically. It'd been a squat for a long time, and it was a really old building, and there was about 30 people living there. And what they did was they ran a sort of Sunday dinner where people could come along and eat and meet each other and things. And it was a really interesting centre. And I got to know people through that.
What about the language? I mean, for most of us, descending on even if it's a European country that speaks a completely different language, is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, well, I didn't learn the Dutch.
The Dutch love speaking English.
They speak a lot of English. So I used to do a thing where I went to the market. I go to the market every week and buy food. And I'd always take a whole load of 2 euro coins, because I knew nothing would cost more than 2 euros. So for everything I bought, I'd give them 2 euros.
Did you do that, Amy? That's so funny.
So it was a way of getting around the fact I couldn't speak the language.
And what have you managed to turn that into, what you learnt at university, the course, into making money? I hate to come back to this, but this whole vocational thing, do you think that it's something that you can somehow turn into something that can help you get an income in the future?
Well, I think the thing that really I was interested in at university was how, like, art can be a tool for personal and social change. That's something I'm really interested in, and how art can be something that can be of benefit to the community. And I'm very interested in, like, sort of what's going on politically around what this government's doing and where we're heading. And I see that art can be a powerful tool within that, as a form of protest or a form of bringing people together, or a way of people processing what's gone on for them. And that was something I was really interested in.
Can you give us an example of how that... I mean, I know I'm thinking actually about things like 1968 in Paris, where there was a lot of artistry involved in these massive street protests right across the city of Paris in the 1960s. But what have you experienced that actually somehow expresses things, which is, I suppose, what we're talking about here, is anger with a society that doesn't seem to care about people?
Yeah, I think an art can articulate something. Like, someone can do a picture that really articulates something, and I think Banksy's really great at that. That his pictures are, like, almost one-line jokes, you know, and that people can look at that and think, can really relate to that. And that's something I'm really interested in. And I made a piece of artwork at uni that was my final degree show piece, which was a flat pack force feeding chair. So the idea was that you'd sort of put it together and people, and then it was just like this idea of how society's forced on us. And I've had that exhibited twice. It got exhibited at the Passion for Freedom exhibition in London, and it also got exhibited at the Bath Art Fringe. And that was really good fun. And we did a performance where we strapped people in it and fed them Angel Delight.
Well, I suppose that is delightful, but that's great because it's two things, isn't it? It's actually quite nice to Angel Delight, but to be force-fed it is something pretty horrific. No, I think it sounds like fantastic stuff you're doing. But you're interested, you're just about to start a club on Mondays, aren't you, in Easton? Can you tell us about that, maybe you, Rosa?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So we're wanting to start a small project on Mondays in September in Easton. The first of which you will hear about on this show is the 14th of September. Then we'll do the 21st of September and the 28th. The idea of the project is to do small art workshops. They're pretty DIY. They're nothing too wild or, you know, the idea is just get people to start making and start being creative. So the first one we're doing on the 14th will be experimental drawing. The second on the 21st will be painting to music. And the last one is going to be collage making and possibly another activity thrown in with that. And the idea is that people come to it, but that we would like them to email us before coming so we have an idea of numbers in terms of materials. And we want to just see what people think about doing the workshops, how they feel about it, maybe have some feedback at the end, have a chat about it, see what worked and stuff. Because, of course, we're relatively new to doing this. We want to create something that's helpful and exciting for people to come to. And also, you know, really make it about the community that are coming to the workshops. You know, we don't want to say this is the way it is and then do something that's not interesting and fun for people, because that's really important.
Now, Amy, I know the Cabelli is just up Robertson Road from the junction of Robertson Road and Stapleton Road in Easton. But tell us a bit about the centre, the place.
Well, it's a political centre. It's an alternative political centre. And it's run on a collective basis. And they're very keen on making things as accessible as possible for people. And they have, like, bike workshops, and they have events where they raise money, and they have a sort of a meal on a Sunday. And the reason why I thought it'd be a really great place to work with is because they have, well, it's a venue that we could use. And also they have an art room, so they had some of the materials already. And I think what I really hope with this project is that we bring more people into the Cabelli Centre. And sort of also, I like the way that they were quite supportive of us doing something different.
Yes, it sounds like an interesting place. Lots going on there. Probably worth... Is it sort of open at any part of the week where people can just sort of pop in and have a look and see what's going on there at all?
I'm not so sure. I know they have a bike workshop and they have a Sunday meal. But yeah, I think if you want to find more details, look on the Cabelli website.
Okay. If you're interested in the Cabelli Centre, but not necessarily in the art, every Sunday, 6:30 to 8:45, delicious vegan dinner for a suggested donation of £2.50, which is rather nice to suggest a donation rather than a charge. So if you're absolutely, you know, maybe you've been sanctioned on benefits or something, then it's only a donation that they're asking for, from 6:30 till 8:45 at the just up from the junction of Robertson Road and Stapleton Road. That's the Cabelli Community Co-op, and the website is network23.org/Cabelli, which is spelled K-E-B-E-L-E. Now, Rosa, how much is your Monday course going to cost? Yours is 7 till 9 every Monday, isn't it, up until the end of September?
Yes, it is 7 till 9 p.m. and it is actually free. Completely free.
What about email address? You want? You said you wanted people to email you.
Absolutely.
And your phone number, please, too.
Yes. So if you would like to get in contact about the workshops and you'd like to come, that would be fantastic, or you just want to ask some questions, you can either call me on 07887 490 484, or you can send me an email on rosahewitt@hotmail.com. You can also look us up on our Facebook page, which is Art at the Kebele Centre. That's K-E-B-E-L-E, as mentioned before. So, those three ways, email, phone, or the Facebook page.
Just one thing, Rosa Hewitt. How do you spell Hewitt?
H-E-W-I-T-T.
Fantastic. What I'll do is I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show, in case you didn't catch them then. So, Rosa Hewitt and Amy Powell, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, he's the author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in USA. And as another anniversary of the September the 11th attacks that have introduced the world to this wonderful concept called the War on Terror, which has really taken any chance away, it seems, of the peace dividend at the end of the Cold War, Webster Tarpley is your man. He's certainly one of the best authors on the subject, and he was in Bristol back in 2008 speaking at QEH Hall about it. But when he was in Bristol all that time ago, I spoke to him about one particular aspect of September the 11th, because he rather took issue with the idea that people in America were having bumper stickers that said Bush knew. So although there were certainly aspects of an inside job to the September the 11th attacks, Webster Tarpley told me, as you're about to hear, that he thought that people misunderstood often George Bush's role, who was Republican president at the time.
Not enough attention has been paid to the political evidence, and the political evidence is two things. One is the ultimatum to Bush from the secret government, from the rogue network. In other words, the people who carry out 9/11 send Bush a threat. Angel is next, Angel being the code word for Air Force One. And it means, Bush, you are a target. With the idea then being, if you don't do what we want, we can do without you. We can liquidate you even in the course of the day. And what they want is the war of civilizations. They want him to announce terrorism. They want him to start talking about bin Laden, Al-Qaeda. They want him to invade Afghanistan. And when this threat comes in at 9 to 10 o'clock in the morning, I have a whole chapter in my book about it. I'm indeed the only person who writes about it. The thing is in the New York Times, confirmed by Condoleezza Rice. There's no doubt that it happened, and it's real. Debka, which is, of course, close to the Mossad in many ways, they confirmed it. Namakon, a group of KGB old boys who have an internet site in Russian, they confirmed it. And Réseau Voltaire, using, I believe, Russian and maybe some French sources, also confirmed that this happened. So Thierry Maison, the first guy who really wrote about 9/11 is also on this line. So the idea, therefore, is that Bush is not a part of this planning. He's not a mastermind. He's not somebody who's, you know, told in advance what's going to happen. He's put in front of a fait accompli. One of the points of this thing is to get him to be active in a way that he would not do otherwise, since his general personality state is catatonic.
And slowly over the day, his line changes.
Right. Yeah, because he said, first he says terrorism in the school in Florida, he says terrorism, and then when he gets to Barksdale, Louisiana, he says, he does not mention terrorism again. And then when he finally makes a speech in Washington in the evening, he makes clear that he has capitulated to the rogue network in the course of the day by saying, we will make no distinction between terrorists and those who harbor them. And by that time, with Richard Clark screaming, bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda the entire day, it's clear that that means he's going to invade Afghanistan. So he has, in effect, capitulated to the rogue network, or, you know, rushed to become their eager puppet. And that's something that, you know, Tony Blair reportedly prodded him to do it. Tony Blair came in on the side of starting the war of civilization. So that's one. That's the angel is next. It was denied later by the White House, but it did happen. And then what? Then we have the drills, right? That's the other thing. 25 plus drills. A lot of them are taking place on the morning of September 11th. Some of them have just been wrapped up in May, June, July, August. Some of them are in advanced stages of planning. So these represent capabilities. 25-plus drills, you don't have to take my word for it. Paul Thompson, even though Paul Thompson really believes in the official version, has done yeoman service. If you look at the 9/11 complete timeline of Paul Thompson at Cooperative Research on the Internet, he's got a whole long article, which is nothing but the drills of 9/11.
Now, probably the most important of those is the nuclear war fighting drill.
That would be the Global Guardian drill, right? That the skies are filled with nuclear bombers, the missiles and submarine-launched missiles are ready to go. Ivashov in Moscow says before any airliner was hijacked, he could see a huge display of thermonuclear power being put into the skies, right, from the satellites and radar that he had. And that is obviously designed to intimidate Russia and to prepare for the fact that in the course of the day, one of the things the rogue network wants is to give an ultimatum to Russia that the U.S. is going to seize Afghanistan, which is a country that in the past Russia had considered essential to her security, and they'd fought, God knows, a bloody war for 10 years to keep the place neutral. And it had remained neutral, more or less. But now the U.S. is going to seize it. A certain kind of Red Army traditionalist might have said, no, that's casus belli. Of course, Putin, much more flexible, highly intelligent. I thank the lucky stars for Putin on that day and since. He is the most intelligent and flexible head of state in the world that we have. And he chose a policy of war avoidance, which was to say to the neocons, you want Afghanistan? Wonderful, take it. You'll see what you find.
Okay.
Weakness and defeat, and Russia will get stronger, and the U.S. will get weaker, and that's exactly what has happened.
That was Webster Tarpley, Webster Griffin Tarpley, to be precise. One of the, I think, best speakers about the September 11th attacks, someone who really puts together how these kinds of operations can be done by remote control, effectively, and somebody who wasn't anything to do with it being blamed, effectively. A conspiracy theory, isn't it, that Osama bin Laden carried out the 9/11 attacks from his little cave down in Afghanistan. And Webster Tarpley's book, if you want to read it, is called 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Back in the late 1990s, the Prophecy Club in the United States took a series of unique insights into prophecy. Not Old Testament style, but modern prophecy, with the focus on how the Bible could be speaking directly to us today. Gail Ripplinger is a US writer who uncovered some shocking ways in which Rupert Murdoch's version of the Bible, yes, he does have one, the translation which he owns is called the New International Version, misses out entire phrases from the original Greek, deleting references to fasting and prayer, for example, and even whole sets of verses are gone, as they are from the New King James Version, which Gail believes has been altered. So here's Gail Ripplinger talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions.
In Madame Blavatsky's book, the title, The One, capital O-N-E, is so prevalent that she has a chapter called The One. And in that book, her occult book called The Secret Doctrine, she says that the dragon is the one, Lucifer is the one, Sanat, which is really just a scramble for Satan, is the one. The serpent is the one. It goes on and on and on. Now, we also see another change in the NIV. Okay, the King James talks about the Lord Jesus Christ, and it says, the household of God, that's all of us who are saved, is built upon the foundation of Jesus Christ, the chief cornerstone. Now, when I was a professor at Kent State University for several years, I taught architecture. And a cornerstone, as defined in an architectural dictionary, is at the foundation of a building. It sets the angles for the building, okay? Now, the NIV has replaced that with the capstone, okay? A capstone is on the top of a building, all right? Now, this was taken off the backside of a dollar. This is the great seal that was put on there by FDR. We all know about his Masonic influence, but Zechariah 11:17 talks about the Antichrist, and it says his right eye shall be utterly darkened. So whoever the Antichrist is only has one eye left to peer out, and there it is. All right. So we've got the capstone instead of the cornerstone. in the new versions. Now, Jesus said, go into all the world and preach the gospel. Just don't use more than 200 words. Okay? Now, he didn't really say that. But can you imagine going into a foreign country or going to Canada or going someplace? You've used 200 words and you've got to get copyright permission from someone to use any more. Because all of the new versions are copywritten. And the copyright law says that anytime you use more than 200 words, and it will say this in the front of many of these editions. In fact, I know of a number of lawsuits. The New American Standard was guilty of suing some missionaries in the Far East. They're not actually suing them, but harassing them, I should say. Until they would quit using more than 200 words. And so, if we can only use 200 words without getting permission for these new versions, who are we going to go to? Okay, who has the power to give us permission to use more than 200 words? Okay, we've got a picture of Brother Bill here, Mr. Greenspan of the Federal Reserve, and Rupert Murdoch. Okay, this came from a national news magazine. It was either Time or Newsweek. They considered these three men the most powerful men in the world. To get permission to use more than 200 words of the NIV, we're going to have to go to this man, Rupert Murdoch. He bought the exclusive printing rights to the New International Version. Why would he do that? Why would he be interested in doing something like that? Now, Mike Royko is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and he referred to Rupert Murdoch as, and I'm quoting here because I would never call anyone this, he called him a scumbag, and he also called him the Prince of Darkness. Now, there's a book out called Murdoch. It's by a gentleman named Shawcross, and it talks about Mr. Murdoch's plan to control the world, all right? And it shows some of the newspapers and some of the tabloids that he owns, and I wanted to put transparencies up, but quite frankly, they were so rude and crude and horrible that I really didn't feel that I could put them up for anyone to see. But the newspaper that he owned in England was called The Sun, and when he took that over, he turned it 10 times worse than the National Enquirer, and it had photos of nude women all through it and all this sort of thing. Wherever he goes, he just degrades everything, and that's why this unsaved, probably, writer for the Chicago Tribune called him the Prince of Darkness. Now, when he called him the Prince of Darkness, there may be more behind that. This is a photograph that Mr. Murdoch evidently posed for. Because, you know, when you're just walking through the office and you're in your conference room, you don't look like this. Okay, you don't have a black table with 13 chairs around it. You don't have red lights on you. You don't have your hands holding the whole globe. Okay, this picture was obviously posed. Okay, now as a Christian, would you pose behind a black table with 13 chairs holding the globe like this with red lights on you? I don't think that you would. And so there's a reason why he called him the Prince of Darkness. Every time Mr. Murdoch poses for pictures, he tries to look spooky. I think he might be spooky, I don't know. But anyway, Mr. Murdoch owns Fox Broadcasting, 20th Century Fox movies, and he's the producer of Bart Simpson. Okay, so those of you who have NIV Bibles, I call them the Bart Simpson Bible, because if you want permission to take 20 minutes out of a Bart Simpson segment, you've got to write to Rupert, and if you want to take more than 200 words from the NIV, you've got to write to Rupert Murdoch. Okay. Now, the editor of the New International Version, the chief editor, has some heretical views about how someone is saved. And so even if we could go into all the world and use an NIV, I don't think anyone would necessarily get saved easily. And here's why. This is what Edwin Palmer said, who's the chief editor of the NIV. He said, this shows the great error that's so prevalent today in some Orthodox Protestant circles. And that, namely the error that regeneration, that's being born again, depends upon faith, and that in order to be born again, one must first accept Jesus as Savior. Now, he's calling this a great error prevalent in Orthodox Protestant circles. Well, now that isn't an error, that's the gospel, okay? But it isn't the gospel in the NIV, okay? We have another gospel there. Corinthians says, if he that cometh preacheth another gospel. The King James says, children, how hard it is for them that trust in riches to enter into the kingdom of God. Okay, the new versions say, children, how hard it is to enter into the kingdom of God. Can you imagine handing a little child a Bible that said, children, how hard it is to enter into the kingdom of God? That's the last thing one would want to do, because it's easy to be saved. One merely needs to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and thou shalt be saved. Okay? So the gospel is a different gospel there. The New King James changes the gospel also. In Matthew 7, the King James says, narrow is the way. Now, a sliding board is narrow, but it's the easiest way to get down once you've worked yourself up that into that bad position that we all work ourselves into. Right? It's the easiest way to get down. All right. Going back down the steps is hard. Remember when you're a little kid, someone says, come back down, it's too steep. Okay. The New King James says, difficult is the way. Now, it's not difficult. Narrow and difficult are not synonyms. Okay. Now, you will find a trend in the new versions, in many cases, where salvation by faith, believeth, faith, is changed to obedience, obey. You're not saved, then you're disobeying, okay? The King James will say we have faith. The new versions, like the New King James or the NIV, will say faithfulness. Okay, I have faith because Jesus is faithful. Okay, I am not always faithful. Now, looking at John chapter 6, verse 47, the King James Bible said, he that believeth on me hath everlasting life. Jesus says, I'm the door, I am the way, okay? The new version simply say, he that believes has everlasting life. Believes what? Well, you can believe absolutely anything as far as they're concerned. Because it doesn't say, on me. The key, he's the door. He's the only way in. He that climbeth up another way is a thief and a robber. But here's it saying, you can just climb up about 50 different ways. Okay? The gospel of Christ. And they just simply say the gospel. They're presenting another doctrine here. The King James is the gospel of Christ, the doctrine of Christ, an heir of God through Christ. They're just simply gospel, doctrine, heir. Matthew 6, the kingdom of God, the spirit of God, the love of God, the angels of God, the gospel, the kingdom of God. This is all heavenly. Okay? This all relates to God. This is all spiritual. The NIV simply says kingdom, spirit, love, angels, gospel. The God is gone. Now, that's not an archaic word. But they want a temporal kingdom down here. They want angels down here. Love down here, not the love of God, the Spirit of God. The focus is away from God here. Okay. Now, something as simple as heaven, our hope, which is heaven, is completely eliminated in these new versions in these verses. Our Father who is in heaven, Father which is in heaven, Father who is in heaven, Son of Man which is in heaven. They've taken the Father out of heaven. It's just Father. Okay, now they're going to take the Son out, the Son of Man, which is in heaven. It's just Son of Man. They're going to take the angels out, the angels which are in heaven. They're just angels. It's not the kingdom of heaven. It's nothing. The temple is not in heaven anymore. They're going to build the temple. The Masons are going to build the temple for us. It's all on earth, taking our mind off God and heaven.
Gail Ripplinger there, talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions, speaking about Rupert Murdoch's new international translation of the Bible, shockingly less accurate than the King James Version, which was translated in Britain in the 17th century. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Sabine McNeil. Also to the artists Rosa Hewitt and Amy Powell. And you can contact them on 07887 490 484. That's 07887 490 484. Or Rosa Hewitt with two T's, Rosa Hewitt at hotmail.com. Dialect's produced by volunteers. At bristolvolunteers.org.uk is the website. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye for now.
I'm gonna get out of the face home. I'm gonna go now.